please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The list of U.S. crimes against humanity is long and unending, and is not confined to the terrorism of American military forces during the Second World War. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kahan International Staff Writer. This article is published under the heading, Racist Terrorism Rules the U.S. Here's the story. What happened recently in the city of Buffalo, where a teenage white-skinned terrorist sadistically slaughtered a dozen people because of dark color of their skin, has once again shocked the civilized world. But it failed to thaw a frozen racist conscience of the U.S., especially the Zionist-controlled clique that rules it. Such killings of the innocent have been regular occurrences in American history since 1660, starting with the European settlers' organized genocide of the Native Amerindians, the so-called Redskins, and has impacted almost every ethnic and racial group in the United States, especially the black people who were kidnapped from Africa and enslaved in the New World. Native Amerindians, who were forced off their lands and relocated to the so-called reservations, have almost become extinct. According to historical evidence, in the second half of the 19th century, within a space of a mere 2 years during the Gold Rush, over 100,000 natives were massacred in California, whose then-governor, Peter Burnett, had infamously said, "The war of extermination will continue to be waged until the Red Indian race becomes extinct." Until a century ago, before the First World War, the U.S. state and federal governments used to pay millions of dollars to white racist militias to murder the Amerindians. This Ku Klux Klan, or KKK, mentality next saw programs against Chinese Americans in the Pacific Northwest, where they were rounded up and expelled from towns under threat of mob rule, while the mistreatment of the Afro-Americans intensified. Thus today, while verbally deploring the frequent killing of the black people by both the white terroristic police force and non-state terrorists, such as Peyton S. Gendron, who carried out the Buffalo Massacre, the state has resorted to the illegal detention of black Americans, increasing the number of incarcerations in the nation's prison system from 300,000 in 1980 to around 3 million at present. In view of these undeniable facts, the crocodile tears shed by President Joe Biden over the recent incidents will neither soothe the broken hearts of the colored citizens nor will end the murderous discriminations against them. After all, this racist, terroristic mentality is ingrained in the top echelons of the so-called White House that was built with black labor and had manifested itself in the person of that hardcore criminal called Donald Trump and his team of murderers who acted with open impudence at both home and abroad, as was proven during the mass uprising of the Afro-Americans during his presidency, and his target killing of the famous anti-terrorism Iranian general Qasem Soleimani. In short, the list of U.S. crimes against humanity is long and unending and is not confined to the terrorism of American military forces during the Second World War against the conquered Japanese or the subdued European peoples of Germany and Italy, who were mass murdered and their women gang raped. It is also not limited to the My Lai mass massacre of over 500 unarmed Vietnamese civilians, including women and children, on March 16, 1968, neither to the Dasht-e Leili massacre in December 2001 in Afghanistan, when some 2,000 prisoners were shot or suffocated to death in metal shipping containers, nor to the Nisour Square massacre in Baghdad on September 16, 2007, as part of the U.S. killing of over 1.2 million Iraqi people. Midstream.
Saif al-Quds. The 11 days battle during May 2021 between the Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip and the Zionist regime, the fiercest in years, made way for unprecedented developments over the past year. The confrontation of the Al-Quds Palestinians and the people of Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood to the policy of the occupation and their displacement from their homes constituted a lever for the launch of a Palestinian uprising, which was able to impose itself on everyone's agenda and bring the cause of Al-Quds back to center stage. The most prominent shift in ground events came with the intervention of the resistance in Gaza, which considered the violations against Al-Aqsa Mosque and the people of Al-Quds a motive to open fire against the occupation, especially after the people of Al-Quds appealed to their brothers in Gaza. The Battle of Saif al-Quds made way for strategic changes in the Palestinian struggle with the Zionist entity. It brought about a new sense of victory to the Palestinian side and a sense of defeat among the Zionists. The main result of this battle was a change of how Zionists view their own position inside Palestine. The settlers' confidence and trust towards the Israeli army and its deterrent power was dealt a heavy blow, because primarily it could not stop the missiles from the Gaza Strip with their usual airstrikes, while unable to storm Gaza with a ground incursion. Secondly, hundreds of resistance missiles from all parts of Gaza penetrated the Iron Dome. Saif al-Quds reaffirmed the unity of the Palestinian struggle in the face of the occupation in al-Quds, the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and the occupied 1948 interior. This founded a practical alternative to the path of reconciliation adopted by the Palestinian Authority, where years had passed without any real breakthrough in that approach. This comprehensive battle was able to establish the Palestinian right in Al-Quds and to refute the occupation's narrative of its right to Judaize Al-Quds and its neighborhoods. Saif al-Quds also allowed the resistance in Gaza to present a professional resistance model and a high ability to confront the Israeli aggression and deal with the plans of the occupation, thus limiting Israel's ability to prolong its aggression against the Palestinians. Saif al-Quds also broke the barriers with the 1948 Palestinians and led to a full-blown uprising, proving beyond any doubt that the occupying state is weaker than what it proclaimed itself to be. Truly, weaker than a spider's web. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. This week, the Palestinian people commemorated the first anniversary of the Sword of Al-Quds battle, known as Saif al-Quds, in which the Palestinian resistance rained thousands of missiles on the occupied Palestinian territories, establishing a new development and resetting the deterrence equation. The Sword of Al-Quds constituted a milestone in the history of the Palestinian conflict with the occupation, as it was a dividing point between the stage of Israeli superiority and the empowerment of the resistance and its blows, which struck the occupied Israeli depths. The battle united the Palestinian people like never before and brought the Palestinian cause back to the fore, after many hypocrites and normalizers with the occupation sought to make it marginal. And some even conspired against it to serve the occupation. To discuss this issue with us from the occupied Al-Quds is Anis Safouri, former Palestinian detainee who spent 12 years in illegal Zionist detention centers and an activist in the Abna al-Balad movement. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Anis. And I know that you are at the moment in the hospital in Al-Quds with our martyr, our hero, Shireen. Shireen Al-Aqli, which was martyred by a sniper in the Israeli occupation army. So that's why you are sitting there in this set right now. We thank you for your effort, for being there. Please do consider yourself as a representative for all of us who are now mourning Shireen and the loss of Shireen. Now, Mr. Anis, Saif al-Quds carried special and exceptional features that distinguished it from other previous confrontations, constituting a defining moment in the entire history of the Palestinian struggle and the developments in the entire region, to be honest with you. What achievements have the Palestinians been able to attain in 2021 or since the 2021 Saif al-Quds confrontations?
The most important achievements of the Palestinian people after Saif al-Quds, or God willing, at the beginning of the liberation, is the unification of the entire Palestinian people under the banner of resistance to the racist Zionist entity, the entity that tried using barbed wire fences and blockades to attempt the conversion of families to separate the Palestinian people from each other and impose a new state in Palestine for its settlers, which it refers to as the Israeli citizens on our land, the land of Palestine. Our Palestinian people truly triumphed because their identity is one, especially that the uprising included all of full historical Palestine. It covered over 27,000 square kilometers, not only in the West Bank, or in Gaza, or in Al-Quds, or Galilee, or the Negev, but all of Palestine was united. This was the most important achievement, because our national identity have existed for thousands of years. And we know that no matter how much the entity tried to isolate us within the occupied territories, we broke that isolation through the Sword of Al-Quds. The second important achievement is the emergence of new generations fixated on the resistance approach. These generations have not previously been involved in the uprisings after the Second Intifada in 2005. The battle Sword of Al-Quds helped engage this generation in the uprising. They did not take part in Earth Day or the First or Second Intifada. Saif al-Quds allowed us to discover this generation inside 1948 Palestinian territories, which proved that they are not afraid of the Zionists, a generation that is more courageous and not afraid of the racist entity.
Mr. Anis, Saif al-Quds battle still represents the most prominent strategic shifts in the conflict with the occupation so far, as it was able to consolidate the failure of the deterrence policy claimed by the Israeli authorities against the Palestinian natives and push towards more cohesion with the occupation, which was basically evident in the escalation of the individual resistance operations inside the interior occupied Palestinian territories, especially in the first few months of 2022. Were the native Palestinians capable of investing quite well the Saif al-Quds battle in maybe strengthening their steadfastness in the face of the occupation?
A real investment for any Palestinian is defending himself and his identity, and living freely within a free Palestinian state. Real investment is in the struggle, the continuity of the struggle. Saif al-Quds gave us all a motivation that did not exist before. It's truly a battle that strategically shifted the level of deterrence. Certainly, the Israeli entity attempts to show itself in a position of power or victory, miserably failed. The biggest proof of this is the killing and the assassination of journalist Shireen Abu Aqli, who was only doing her job and covering the entity storming into the Jenin refugee camp. As usual, when the entity is not able to confront the Palestinian resistance or resistance in southern Lebanon or any resistance from the rest of the region, it turns to killing children, nurses, and journalists in order to create a state of deterrence. The descent of the Palestinian people to the street, and the preparations for a new uprising in Al-Quds during the funerals of the martyrs proved that the Palestinian people have taken the decision to remain free, whatever the price may be. This is the message of our Palestinian people, a practical one from the ground, not just talk.
Mr. Anis, this comprehensive battle in Al-Quds and in Gaza and the West Bank and the interior 1948 occupied territories was able to establish the Palestinian right for Al-Quds and to refute the occupation's narrative of its right to Judaize Al-Quds and its neighborhood, and led to the formation of what we now know as the regional axis of Al-Quds, known as Mihwar Al-Quds, in which all West Asia's axis of resistance is on board. Now, if Zionist Israel maintains its current provocations against the worshippers of the Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied Al-Quds, might we witness an all-out regional war in support of Al-Aqsa, in support of Al-Quds?
It's possible to see a war, but not because of the peoples of our region. The history of the peoples in our region testifies for thousands of years that they love peace. We are a peace-loving people. But the actions of the Zionist entity is what pushes the peoples of the region for fighting with this entity. Al-Quds today is the compass of the free world. Al-Quds is a symbol for the cause of the oppressed people of the world. Al-Quds is a symbol of the state of oppression of the Palestinian people. Of course, I respect the heavenly sanctity of Al-Quds, but I speak at the level of humanity, and especially for the oppressed people. How Al-Quds has national symbolism for them. The Zionist entity is the one who always seeks war in the region. Since the infiltration of the Zionist entity into our region, we have never seen a day of peace, neither here nor in the world. This war is a war imposed on the peoples of our region because of the racist state, which is the occupying entity. Just like the Nazis were eliminated in Europe, just as Daesh was eliminated in our region, we must get rid of Zionism in our region.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Mr. Anis Safouri, former Palestinian detainee, who spent 12 years in illegal Zionist detention centers and activists in the Abna al-Balad movement. Thank you very much for being with us, despite the fact that you are visiting our very appreciated martyr, Shireen Abu Aqli, at the hospital. Thank you for giving us the time to be with us and talk to us. Now, please stay tuned, because next We will be talking about how the Zionist entity assassinated in cold blood a journalist.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Shirin Abu Aqli was a household name across the Arab world, literally, across the region and beyond. Her calm, commanding presence filled living rooms, courtyards, and camps as viewers turned to the new Al Jazeera Network 24-hour Arabic TV news channel. Joining in 1997, a year after its launch, Shirin made her own history. For a new generation of young Arab women who came of age then and are now a driving force in journalism, she was the first female correspondent they've seen on their television screens. Shirin Abu Aqli was assassinated in cold blood by an Israeli sniper while covering a raid by Israeli occupation forces on Jenin camp in the occupied West Bank. Shirin's martyrdom became a powerful and painful reminder of the huge and growing price paid by journalists covering the continuous Palestinian struggle against the monstrous Zionist occupation. More in this following report.
Veteran Al Jazeera journalist Shirin Abu Aqli has been shot and killed by Israeli forces while reporting in Jenin in the occupied West Bank. The assassination last Wednesday sparked an outpouring of condolences and condemnation, as well as calls for a thorough investigation to hold the occupation to account. In a statement, Al Jazeera Media Network condemned the blatant murder that violates international laws and norms and called Abu Aqli's death a heinous crime through which it is intended to prevent the media from fulfilling its message. Al Jazeera also held the Israeli government and the occupation forces responsible for the intentional targeting and killing of Abu Aqli. Al Jazeera Network said that the Israeli soldiers targeted its correspondent with a direct shot. It quoted eyewitnesses as saying that a sniper targeted Shirin with a bullet in the face, even though she was wearing a jacket and helmet bearing the logo of the press, and that the Israeli soldiers fired live bullets at the demonstrators and press crews. Journalist Ali Samoudi, who was accompanying Abu Aqli and was shot in the upper back, said, "What happened is that we were on our way to cover the Israeli army operation. Suddenly they shot at us. They didn't ask us to leave. They didn't tell us to stop. They shot us. A bullet hit me. A second bullet hit Shirin. They killed her in cold blood because they are killers." Ali added in a video recording sitting in a wheelchair at the hospital with bandages on his shoulder. Shirin's body was carried through the streets of Jenin, draped in the Palestinian flag with the press jacket she was wearing. Reporters and photojournalists circled the funeral, this time having to cover the death of one of their own. Shirin was a much-loved reporter and one of the region's most experienced. Her familiar face has always been part of the coverage of major events in the region, and generations of Palestinians have grown up watching her on television as one of the most famous correspondents in covering the continuous Zionist aggression on Palestine. Abu Aqli is considered one of the veteran Arab journalists, and since joining Al Jazeera, she has covered most of the prominent events in the Palestinian territories, and she was one of the most famous war correspondents. After her death, a number of tweeters expressed their grief over her death, and some of them said that they considered her as a member of their families due to her great influence and her long presence on screen. The martyrdom of colleague Shirin Abu Aqli is a crime that has been added to the criminal record of the Zionist entity, and it is imperative for the media and journalist body to unite to denounce it and to make it our duty to amplify the suffering of the Palestinian people so the entire world can hear and see the brutality of the occupation.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Julia Qasim, political writer and commentator. Thank you for being with us. Now, blue body armor emblazoned with the word press in bold white letters placed on her wooden coffin, on the coffin of our slain martyr journalist, Shireen Abu Aqli. It was a powerful and a painful reminder that journalists are paying a heavy price because of the Israeli continuous brutal aggression against all of Palestinians, but especially against journalists. I don't understand why the world acted surprised when Shireen was assassinated, as if this is something that Israel does for the first time. Why do you think the mainstream media dealt with her assassination the way it did?
Right. As you said, it's far from being the first time. 50 journalists at least have been assassinated just since 2000. And this doesn't include notable cases before that date, since such as the 1987 murder of Najih El-Ali. But as we're getting to a point, especially where in this time where the Israel's war crimes are documented out in the open, and this started to proliferate after the introduction of media in Palestine, of Arab media, of Palestinian media, proliferating in the mid to late 1990s, that also accompanied the rise of the internet, it posed like more of a threat for Israel to maintain its pretext of democracy and civilization in the Middle East, and more clearly exposed its the reality of its incessant war crimes. And so the mainstream media basically is in a walking contradiction because it wants to present itself as the authoritative voice on objectivity, but at the same time, it's accountable to capital, it's accountable to empire, and it's accountable to the military-industrial complexes of the United States and Israel, which it maintains a close relationship with their military apparatus and with their intelligence apparatuses, which essentially drive its lines. So this accountability creates this contradiction where there is a denial of the injustices that are happening to Palestinians. At the same time, the world can see its war crimes out in the open as they have been. So these are also reflected in the editorial guidelines of mainstream media, which deliberately leave no space for the Palestinian narratives, the recognition for Palestinians as the sovereign owners of the land, and of course, as ones that are being ethnically cleansed by the settler colonial occupation.
There's something interesting that happened where Israel cannot lie about it anymore, as you just clearly stated, Julia. But Shireen's colleague and one of the eyewitnesses of her assassination is journalist Ali Samoudi, who was injured himself during that day, said that the occupation deliberately killed Shireen and injured the rest of the crew, even though the place was free of any protesters, demonstrators, or even people throwing stones, for that matter, in the area. Why do you think the occupation assassinated Shireen in specific?
So there is the aspect of Shireen being a prominent journalist, as you said, for all these years, who was a trailblazer in her field, but also an iconic figure that exposed the Zionist war crimes, essentially, in her profession by reporting from on the ground. And being front and center in showing the world what was happening to the Palestinians. So there was her as a figure that was a deliberate target. Second, there's the contextual element of Jenin and of the West Bank facing a renewed and increased siege from the Zionist entity after the resistance forces of, after the Palestinian resistance have consolidated their alliance and are working in unity, particularly after last year's Safe of Jerusalem occupation, successfully and to a level that is a very big threat to the Zionist entity. And the specific site that Shireen was reporting on just last Wednesday when she was martyred was a Zionist attack on the Jenin camp. Mm-hmm. Where there also was a 18 and a 21-year-old murdered, representing also the demographic of young resistance fighters that are posing the biggest threat to the Zionist entity, fighting an armed struggle against the occupation.
Which this brings us to how the Palestinian Authority dealt with it. I mean, I heard and I read for Prime Minister Mohammed Ishtayeh, who called for an international investigation involving what he called the United Nations and various parties into also what he called the murder of Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Aqle. Why is the PA still believing that the so-called international community can bring justice to any Palestinian cause is truly a mystery to me. I mean, entire neighborhoods were wiped out in Gaza last year during the Israeli aggression on Gaza after the resistance tried to help out al-Quds with Saif al-Quds. And not a word came out from this international community. Why should this case be any different?
Right, there's a certain level of hypocrisy that came out of certain officials representing the Palestinian Authority to the UN and to international agencies such as like Riyad Mansour, who were rejecting the possibility of an Israeli probe into attack, while at the same time calling for example, the UN, or some others were calling for the U.S. to do an investigation. Of course, even if this investigation turns up any modicum of truth more than Israel's potential investigation would, which I don't expect it to really have any different objectives in doing so as allies in maintaining the occupation. But it's just a way for them to kind of maintain their role as the auxiliary representatives of the Palestinian bourgeois class that has basically sold out the sovereignty of Palestinians and of Palestine in exchange for just kind of like some elite control. But also appealing to the international community is increasingly popular in this regard because the U.S. and the EU can kind of claim to also be impartial in relegating the Palestinian, the issue of the occupation of Palestine and of the injustices that come out of that as a human rights issue rather than a sovereignty issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, I definitely hear that, especially that in the international law, Palestine is occupied, but in their notions and in their understanding, it's not. So we're not going to wait for them to understand it, that it is. I want to thank you very much, Julia Qasim, political writer and commentator from Beirut, joining us to talk about the assassination of Shirin al-Aqle while doing her job, exposing the Zionist entity who was trying to storm Jenin camp last week. Thank you very much for being with us, Julia. Thank you for your contribution. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Mideast Stream.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
New data from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, shows that the weekly average CO2 concentration at the Mauna Loa Observatory in Hawaii reached 421.13 parts per million, ppm, from May 8 to May 14th. The highest in recorded history and up from 418.34 ppm 1 year ago and 397.38 ppm 1 decade ago. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Kenny Stencil, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Earth's Atmospheric CO2 Hasn't Been This High in Millions of Years. Here's the story. Climate scientists and concerned citizens are sounding the alarm as daily, weekly, and monthly records for atmospheric carbon dioxide levels continue to be shattered while the fossil fuel-powered capitalist economic system responsible for skyrocketing greenhouse gas pollution plows ahead. New data from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, shows that the weekly average CO2 concentration at the Mauna Loa Observatory in Hawaii reached 421.13 parts per million ppm from May 8 to May 14th, the highest in recorded history and up from 418.34 ppm 1 year ago and 397.38 ppm 1 decade ago. We simply do not know a planet like this, meteorologist Eric Holtus said recently, adding, we are in a climate emergency. According to NOAA, the daily average CO2 concentration at Mauna Loa hit 422.4 ppm on May 14th, just slightly below the agency's all-time record of 422.6 ppm, observed on April 26th. Researchers from Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego, meanwhile, measured 421.68 ppm of CO2 at Mauna Loa on May 13th, which they consider the daily record recently. Those record-breaking daily and weekly measurements came after the monthly average CO2 concentration at Mauna Loa surpassed 420 ppm for the first time in human history, with NOAA observing 420.23 ppm in April compared with the Scripps at 420.2 ppm. Peter Tenz, a senior scientist at NOAA, recently told Axios that it is likely May will be higher still. The window to act on climate change is closing. American Clean Power warned recently on social media, adding, Accelerating the transition to clean energy will help reduce emissions and secure a healthier future for all. 20 years ago, the highest monthly average CO2 concentration was 375.93 ppm, according to NOAA. In 1958, the first year scientists began collecting data at Mauna Loa, it was 317.51 ppm. Climate scientist James Hansen, who alerted congressional lawmakers to the life-threatening dangers of the climate crisis in 1988, has long called for reducing atmospheric CO2 to below 350 ppm, and there is now a scientific consensus that the livability of the planet decreases beyond such a concentration. Nevertheless, the annual rate of increase in CO2 levels over the past six decades is now roughly 100 times faster than earlier increases that occurred naturally thousands of years ago. Tan said earlier this month, "The world effectively has made no serious progress compared to what is required. We really need to focus on decreasing emissions, and we haven't had much success globally because the rate of increase of CO2 remains as high as it has been in the last decade." He noted, "CO2 has a longevity of hundreds to thousands of years, so we are really making a very long-term climate commitment." Speaking with the Financial Times recently, Tans decided that we are going in the wrong direction at maximum speed. California-based activist Joe Sandberg put it even more bluntly, saying, "It's shocking that we are staring down the barrel of the greatest existential crisis humanity has ever faced, and we still haven't passed a Green New Deal. Time is running out. Either we drive the fossil fuel industry into extinction or the human race."
Eight-year defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Iran, sponsor of regional unrest or victim of terrorism? Former Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Mousavi says Iran is the biggest victim of terrorist actions, which have been taken mainly with the U.S. government's direct and indirect support. Well, the MEK, a cult-like terror group that killed 17,000 Iranians, partly in collaboration with the enemy Saddam Hussein in time of war, is now nestled in Albania, in Europe, as its headquarters. But the MEK's got more than that. It's got strongholds in several Western hotspots that host more than the MEK or MKO. While this organization is out to overthrow the establishment and take over itself, other armed terror groups, such as Al-Ahwaziyya, are out to separate whole Iranian provinces. And they, too, have their members nestled away in the world's hotspots, or supported by them at least. Now, what's a wonder is how Western governments have managed to keep these criminals among their own people this long. To see how and why this happens, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. We'll be right back. Sweden appears to want a prisoner swap to rescue a designated Israeli spy. That would be an Ahmad Reza Jalali for a Hamid Nouri. Jalali is an Iranian, well now Swedish-Iranian, who was arrested during an academic visit to Iran in 2016 and accused of spying for Israel to help it assassinate several senior nuclear scientists. This is while Nouri was arrested upon entering Sweden in 2019 and is on trial for war crimes. Hard as it might be to believe Dr. Jalali, an academic, would commit treason, Sweden's support makes you wonder, given it would be an unequal prisoner swap, case-wise and time-wise.
When the topic of prison exchange is raised, a swap is for when the two sides are charged with the same crimes and there's a balance. But when a person who was a simple judiciary official was taken into custody years after his retirement on a trip by an illegal court for completely political reasons is put on trial, you cannot ask for a swap here with a real spy. We are certain Jalali is charged for spying, but we won't go into the details of that case. Nonetheless, espionage by this person may have been proven, and he may have received a death sentence. In essence, the charges against these two people are not the same and are independent cases. And these efforts to make this swap take place shows that the Sweden government really wants Jalali. Meaning if Jalali was not important to the Swedish government, it wouldn't try to reclaim him.
Iran has no intention of doing a swap or releasing Jalali for that matter. Judiciary spokesman Zabiullah Khodayan on May the 10th confirmed there was no connection between the Jalali and Nouri cases, unless perhaps Nouri was arrested for a swap or sending a message to the Iranian government.
Hamid Nouri was arrested, held in solitary confinement for a very long time and denied the right to an attorney, and during this time under various pressures, he was deprived of basic rights given by civilized countries. But the strangeness of this case comes when the Swedish court begins procedures and the prosecutor reads the indictment. Then it's the turn of the plaintiffs, who are former members of the Mujahideen Khal organization, or the MKO, and they express their legal action against the defendant, and witnesses give their testimony against the defendant, meaning Hamid Nouri. We see that no witness testimony is given against Hamid Nouri, neither from witnesses nor those who are members of the MKO.
A Norway-based campaign group, Iran Human Rights, has accused Iranian officials of threatening to execute Jalali in retaliation for the war crimes trial of Nouri. But Jalali was convicted 2 years earlier than Nouri, so if anything, it would work the other way round. Iran's Supreme Court upheld the death sentence for Jalali in 2017, and he will be executed by 21st of May this year. This is while Nouri was arrested in 2019 and faces life in jail. Jalali was given Swedish citizenship in late February 2018, according to Stockholm. International human rights organizations claim Jalali confessed under torture. How do we know that he is a spy indeed?
The case of Jalali has no relation with the case of Hamid Nouri. Mr. Jalali was arrested 2 years before Hamid Nouri. He was a doctor in Iran before leaving the country. He had links with the Israeli spy agency Mossad. He was in communication with them and had leaked the intelligence to Mossad. While he was in the country, he worked with two strategic ministries on a project basis. In a set of televised confessions, it says he came to Iran and collected information on the whereabouts of Shahid Shahriari and Shahid Ali Mohammadi. When Jalali goes back to Europe, he was in communication with Mossad. He was fully aware that he wasn't taking scientific information out of the country.
But Nouri in Sweden was charged with international war crimes and human rights abuses in connection with the executions of more than 100 people at Gohardasht prison in Karaj in 1988, the key phrase being in connection with. Sounds awful, except that claims against him are mostly implied by the MKO. Regional terror groups are no enigma, and there's no question of their crimes. The same goes for Iran's homegrown terrorists, anti-Iran groups that are housed and or supported by the West via Iran's regional rivals such as Saudi Arabia and partly at the behest of Israel, the West's military camp in the region, West Asia.
Last year, the Lebanese newspaper Ra'y al-Yawm published a series of important documents about cyber units and robots. Israeli regime has roughly 100 units in this regard. It's interesting to know these units even use schools and students to influence various political figures in different countries. It's not limited to Iran. They're also investing in Arab fields as well. Saudi Arabia is doing the same. The New York Times newspaper reported Saudi Arabia has invested some $150 million in this field to expand its cyber war network.
The Mojahedin-e Khalq organization, MKO or MEK, was established in 1965 in a bid to overthrow the Shah or King at gunpoint. It harbored an anti-Western and anti-US ideology and even killed many US officials in this country. Not to leave the best of the Americans out, they also kidnapped the US ambassador to Iran. Former US President Bill Clinton designated the group as an FTO, foreign terrorist organization, in 1997. While it was on that terror list, however, it received training from the Bush administration, according to the prize-winning journalist Seymour Hersh. The MEK training took place at the Department of Energy's Nevada National Security Site, about 65 miles northwest of Las Vegas. Finally, in 2012, the U.S. State Department removed the MEK from its list of designated terrorist organizations. This happened under intense lobbying by groups associated with Saudi Arabia and other regimes opposed to Iran, basically Israel. In spite of having mustered up nothing but hate in Iran, the MEK cult has never been a burnt-out card to the U.S. itself. If not for action in overthrowing the Iranian establishment, they have their uses for espionage. It was revealed by a 2012 NBC News report that MEK's brutal assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists has been committed via training and arming by Israel's Secret Service.
Any security intelligence agency needs people who are completely familiar with the culture of subjects of interest. For example, for the British, Germans, French and Dutch, it's very important to employ Iranians so that they can analyze for them issues that concern Iran. Because a real Iranian national has every quality to analyze matters related to Iran rather than someone who learns Farsi as a second language, meaning they are attractive subjects for intelligence and security organizations. These individuals are employed by European intelligence agency, notwithstanding their backgrounds, and are active and even give asylum rights. These individuals are later used as pressure leverage against the Iranian government to force it to accept their request.
Whatever the early motive of the founders of the group MEK and whatever their cause for such bitterness, basically not being allowed to run in post-revolutionary presidential elections and so forth, their actions have nothing to show other than rot at the core of the group's ideology and later leaders. What they present as their militant revolutionary belief is an unfitting amalgamation of opposing ideologies, Islam, Marxism, and democracy, while they practice none. And they run the organization as a cult with extreme measures and cruelty for members and not leaders. To receive guidance with no distraction, members must devote all love and worship to the rulers Mr. and Mrs. Rajavi, who were joined by a very inexplicable marriage. Having participated in overthrowing the Shah in a bid to share power post-revolution and having failed in the latter, the MKO bombed the headquarters of the Islamic Republic Party, killing Mohammad Beheshti, the party leader, and scores of others. 2 months later, they killed the newly elected President Rajai and Prime Minister Bahonar by an embedded bomb. And so they moved to Iraq in 1986 and allied with Saddam, providing him with intelligence and even militarily attacking Iran. Now my question is, how might the Iranian system have performed so poorly for anyone outside to presume a group hated by Iranians for their treasonous acts of terror might stand a chance here? or for a group like Al-Ahwaziya to presume infiltration into and recruiting from the populace. The name Al-Ahwaziya refers to Ahwaz city in Iran's oil-rich south.
The separatist schools of thought and anti-revolution sentiments have existed since the beginning of the victory of the Iranian Islamic Revolution. In the early days after the revolution, you could see the Democratic Party in Kurdistan. Another example is the Communist Union in the city of Amul in the north of Iran, or the separatists of Sistan and Balochistan and Khuzestan provinces. These have continuously existed and the enemies used them against the Iranian government. Their objective isn't to influence ordinary people. Their goal is to use these factions to divide and separate portions of the country.
Time for a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
In brewing trouble and trying to divide and rule, America, be it Trump's America or Israel's America, was pandering quite a lot to Iran's Kurds. This is while the MKO served as an asset to Saddam Hussein when it came to his bloody crackdown on the Iraqi Shia and Kurdish populations.
Even before the victory of the Islamic Revolution, this very same MKO terrorist group played a key role in the assassination of American engineers, who used to work at Iran's oil industry, in the province of Khuzestan. But after the revolution, these terrorists first fled to Iraq and then to some European countries. During the Shia Intifada in 1991, against Saddam in the south of Iraq, the MKO group assisted Saddam in the mass murder of these Iraqis. Statistics indicate that over 150,000 of Iraqi Shias were murdered at that time.
Press reports cite MKO or MEK leader Maryam Rajavi encouraging members, "Take the Kurds under your tanks and save your bullets for the Iranian Revolutionary Guards," as cited by the New York Times of 2003. Understandably, Saddam Hussein backed them till his end in 2003. What isn't understandable is why a supporter and needler of Kurds, America, or an advocate of human rights, Sweden, would support the group. They've done despicable things to one another. Members have fallen victim to victimize.
The members of these terrorist groups, such as the MKO, who are active in Germany, France, the Netherlands, and other places, have published so much content against one another. Each one blames the other of killings, torture, and human rights abuses. It's interesting that all of these books have been written and published in Europe, meaning the members of this organization have probably published hundreds of books and articles against each other. If a legal organization or court were to analyze these claims of torture, killings, and so forth, it will conclude that members of this organization have committed human rights abuses, committed crimes against humanity over and over again, so they would expel these people from their countries immediately, as they would see them a threat for their people.
The Intercept in 2020 published an article by Murtaza Hussein and Matthew Cole. Six defectors in Europe revealed how the MEK cult isolated, disappeared, and tortured many of its cadres into submission, including forcing dozens of female members to have sex with Masoud Rajavi and undergo medical sterilization so that they could devote themselves more fully to the leader and his cause.
At one point, the French government became suspicious of the activities of Maryam Rajavi, who was leading NKO. The French government ordered the arrest of her and her companion.